Good evening. We once again bid you welcome and are glad to see you here with us tonight. Have some visiting with us and some that have returned to us. As always, we're simply glad to see so many people interested in and desiring to serve the Lord, worship with His people, and together consider His Word to us. You can join me if you'd like in Matthew chapter 8. We're going to continue our reading and study from Matthew chapter 8 here in just a few moments. I find myself oftentimes wondering, not wondering as much maybe as just trying to put myself in the position, trying to transport my mind in some way back to this time, to the time when Jesus was walking among us, doing the wonderful things that He did, going about doing good, as the Scriptures describe Him as doing. What must that have been like for the common, everyday person, for the you and me type of guy who would be in a city like Capernaum, perhaps? What must that environment have been like? What kind of conversations would you be having with your friends about this man who is doing something? What would the atmosphere be like? What would the response be like each time Jesus went into a new place? Here's a person who is teaching radical things. Obviously, there's a lot of wisdom in what he is saying, and obviously a lot of people are responding to it positively. But he is saying things that are radical, that are challenging, that are quite shocking to many people who would hear them. But maybe even more than that, for the initial audience at least, what might have been even more surprising, here's a man who is doing things that no one has seen before in their lifetimes. Things that can't be explained rationally. Things that, as we continue reading further into the narrative and even into the book of Acts when his apostles are doing some of the same things, acts that not even his opponents even wasted energy trying to disprove or trying to say he didn't actually do that. It's always just kind of agreed upon by enemy and friend alike that those people who came to Jesus with illnesses were being healed. The people who came that were possessed by a demon were leaving without being possessed by that demon. The man who came that was maimed was going back home whole. The person who was blind was receiving his sight again. There's little question, again, even in his harshest critics, that he is doing something. Now, of course, their argument is going to come about, how's he doing that? He has demonic power. He's a sorcerer. He's pulling people away with magic. That was the opinion that's still recorded for us, in fact, in the Jewish Talmudic writings, the writings of the rabbis who came after Jesus, that he dissuaded many people from true Israel, that he pulled away many people from the Lord through sorcery. He was a magician of some kind that used dark arts in order to convince people of his power. But everyone who comes to see Jesus notices that he is doing something incredible. What would happen today? I know people today tend to be very skeptical, and rightly so in a lot of instances. We tend to be very skeptical anytime we hear of something. A person has been healed. Okay. I know there are a lot of ways you can fake that. But if there really were someone who is going from town to town in our state, and when people go out to him, there aren't some people who show up and he says, I'm sorry, you don't have enough faith, or you know, the conditions in the energy zone that we're in the world here are not such that I can actually heal you. I can't do anything for you. You have to go home. But maybe this other guy over here I can heal, and he performs some kind of dance over him and that man is healed. No, there's nothing like that. Instead, every person, and they come by the thousands, who visits this man with some kind of infirmity, some kind of sickness, some kind of ailment, every single one of those people goes home completely healed. He has a perfect record, a 100% completion percentage. All of this is happening with no argument that anyone can really raise. They put them in all kinds of different scenarios, put them in a room with just one person, put them outside with no props, no stage around, and surround them with thousands of people, and you still get the same results. And you know, you've been talking to some friends of yours, relatives, who are reputable people, smart people, not gullible, naive, credulous people. And maybe they've seen him, they've been to him, they've been recipients of his power. There's just no doubting the power that this man has by this point. What would our culture be like? How would we be responding to that? I think we would be likely to find what Matthew portrays for us as the reality of what did happen. He's drawing a crowd. At the very least, there are thousands more people in addition to the multitudes who simply came for the healing. Now we've just got crowds who are around to see something, even if not to benefit from the healing, just to simply observe it. Maybe hear him out. See what he has to say. Watch him do something that is truly incredible, that defies explanation. We saw back in Matthew chapter 4, verse 24, his fame went throughout all Syria. And in verse 25, great multitudes followed him from, Matthew points out for us, really every region, every direction that you can go from Galilee where he was. There were people who were drawn to that point in order to see and to hear Jesus. Chapter 8 and verse 1, when he came down from the mountain after delivering that astonishing teaching from the mount, when he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. Verse 16, when evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he healed all who were sick. And so verse 18, where we're picking up this evening, Jesus saw great multitudes about him. He's drawing a crowd. He is drawing attention. People are coming to see. People are coming to observe and to see for themselves. What exactly is going on here? So the question that we really begin with in this first section of our text tonight, verses 18 through 22, what motivates these followers, if we want to even call them that word at this point? What motivates the people who have come to investigate? Why were they seeking him out? What should they be doing? What do they need to be thinking about as they begin following this Son of God? Verse 18 does tell us that when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. Remember, they are near the Sea of Galilee. Then a certain scribe came and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Then another of his disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Here are two of the men who would be a part of this crowd. They've been seeing what Jesus is doing, hearing what he's been saying. And these are two of the possible responses to him. The first man, if we can perhaps read a little bit into what he is doing here, what is actually taking place in this conversation, might be a bit self-important. Here he is making a pretty big, bold, apparently public declaration and claim about his piety. "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Interestingly, and in counterpoint to the two men that we observed this morning, the man afflicted with leprosy and the centurion who both come to Jesus, you notice that in both cases, the sentences they speak have Jesus as the subject. "Lord, you are the important part of this. If you are willing, you can make me clean. You have but to speak a word and my servant will be healed." This man instead comes to Jesus and starts talking about what I'm going to do. "Here's what I'm going to do for you, Lord. I'm going to follow you. You don't have to worry because I'm with you. And between the two of us, maybe we can just really get this whole thing going the way it needs to. I'm your man. I'm with you. I will follow you wherever you go." This could explain the somewhat chilly response that Jesus seems to give to him in verse 20. Instead of maybe what we would anticipate, a man who comes up to Jesus and says, Lord, I'm with you, I'm going to follow you. We would expect a human to respond to that by saying, great, good, finally, I need men like you. I'm glad somebody's finally ready to jump in here. Instead, Jesus, perhaps seeing the heart of this man and answering in kind, says, you say you're willing to follow me wherever I will go, but are you sure? Do you know what you're talking about? Are you really ready to make a statement like that? This man's very devout-sounding plan is something that does not appear to make a significant imprint on Jesus, who simply warns and gives caution and instructs about what it means to actually follow him. It means not knowing what's going to happen next. You say you'll follow me wherever you go, but you don't know where that is, and I don't think you understand the import of that yet. We notice also this man, we mentioned this a little bit earlier this morning, this man refers to Jesus as teacher, which in Matthew's gospel is not always a signal of very much respect. Oftentimes we find people approaching him with the Lord, which tends to indicate a disciple or a believer. His critics often speak to him with the faux respect of teacher, rabbi. I don't know what it is with this man. Perhaps we are reading too much into it and making him more of a villain than I am making him tonight, or more of a villain than we should understand him to be. But the response Jesus gives doesn't seem to indicate a lot of hopefulness, perhaps, on the Lord's part, that this man knows what he is getting into and really understands the nature of following Jesus. The second man, on the other hand, seems to be a bit reluctant. The first guy is too quick and the second guy is too slow. Jesus says, if you're going to follow me, do it. Don't tell me about when you're going to, after what you're going to follow me. You follow me. He appears unwilling to commit too much to the cause of Christ. Both of these things are problems. If we were to have the self-importance, the perhaps self-importance of the first man, or the reluctant sort of shrinking zeal of the second man, both would be problematic, but the second one, I think, especially so. We too often allow in ourselves a malleable assessment of priorities, if we can think of it in that way, priorities that are prone to shifting and changing at a moment's notice, a way of prioritizing things that really ultimately defeats the very idea of having priorities to begin with. For instance, we say that God is the most important thing in my life. Serving Jesus Christ is the most important thing to me. And it's easy to say that. It's easy to say it and to mean it. When you're in a church building, when you're at a Bible study, when you're saying a prayer with someone, when you're at a moment of deep reflection, it's very easy to say that. And that is true for a very long time, for most parts of our lives perhaps, until the time that he isn't the most important part. Something else has come up. I couldn't have foreseen that it was going to happen, but Lord, this situation has arisen and now I've got to reshuffle things and I've got to put the priorities in a different order now, and I'm sorry, but you lost this one. You're second place for a little while, but I'll put you back on top where you belong as soon as I've handled this other thing, this pressing thing that I need to take care of. What's the point in saying from the first place that he is the most important thing, that he is in first place? Something truly demanding in our eyes has come up. Well, then what does that make our Lord? This seems harsh, what Jesus says to him, doesn't it? Let the dead bury their dead. That seems a harsh statement. The guy is not allowed to go and bury a dead relative, if indeed that is what has happened. Some have tried to soften the blow of this a little bit by saying it seems likely this man's father was not at this moment waiting to be buried, but perhaps was in his old age and the man was waiting, maybe taking care of the family business until things sorted themselves out. I don't know the truthfulness of any of those things or not. Regardless of what happens, let's say that this man's father is in fact at this moment lying dead, and there are mourners circling the tomb, ready to go and actually place him in his burial tomb, we immediately would begin to take exception and figure out how this can't really be the case, and why morally this couldn't be the case that Jesus would say something like this to a guy who does want to follow him. Surely Jesus would understand that he can't come with him right at this moment because he has a unique problem that demands his attention right now. Jesus would understand that, wouldn't he? Would he? That seems a bit of a far assumption to me that Jesus is just willing at every chance to say, yeah, you take care of that other stuff and then get to me when you do have a chance. I get that. I know life is hard. You take care of the first things first. I'll be here. I don't know that he would understand to begin with, but B, and perhaps more importantly, is that really the point? Are we trying to get to the point where Jesus simply understands and allows our weakness and our need for convenience? Or are we really determined to follow him? Where and exactly how low have we set the bar for ourselves when we commit ourselves to Christ that we're trying to just say, he understands if I need to do something else first? Jesus will get that if I need to take care of this other problem that I have, this other immediate, urgent thing that needs my concerted attention. He'll get that. The indication from this passage would be, I don't think he does. He tells you to follow him. Make that your first priority in life, that you are seeking him out. If this statement seems harsh, I would submit that's precisely why Jesus said it. This is the attitude that we need to have, that we must cultivate if we are really going to be disciples. That there is literally nothing that will keep us from following him. And again, we can't allow that standard to change depending on present circumstances. It's a very convenient thing, isn't it, to say, look, Lord, this is an unprecedented thing. And for this guy, it is. I mean, if it is, in fact, that he's really going to bury his father, you only do that once in life. Give me 5 minutes. Give me an hour. Then I'm all yours. The point isn't the cruelty, the lack of compassion, the coldness of Jesus to simply say, no, don't do that. I need all of you. It is rather to recognize that he has the right to demand that. And that is what he asks of us, that we give him everything, all of our moments, all of our attention, all of our time. And if our attitude is that other pressing things are going to take precedence over that sometimes, I think the response Jesus would have for us would be, you're not following me then. Count the cost. Consider what you're actually saying if you intend to be one of my disciples. Both of these men, it appears, have some work to do if they're going to get there. But is this Christ even worthy to be followed with such devotion? Let's learn a little bit more about who and what he is. We continue on in verse 23. Again, here we're going to find for us described the man who is commanding such devotion, who says, let the dead bury their own dead. You follow me. Even though you might not have a place to lay your head tonight, you follow me. Now, when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves. But he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we are perishing. But he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be, that even the winds and the sea obey him? Most are familiar in previous studies with the unique geographic features of the Sea of Galilee. A small sea is really kind of a boastful name for it. We would think of it as a lake, probably, most likely. But this small body of water that's in a bowl, a depressed bowl surrounded by mountains, about 700 feet below sea level at the surface. And that unique geography lends itself to a lot of pretty impressive storms that can be kicked up over the waters at the right time. With those mountains nearby, its situation in the land, storms on the sea could be devastating, especially to smaller vessels. And we should point out in this account that we have on board this ship probably several, if not all of the men other than Jesus, experienced fishermen, experienced men of the water, who think that they are going to perish in this one. These are not people who are overreacting to some choppy water. Maybe when you go out on a boat with someone who hasn't been on a boat before, and the first time you hit the wake of some bigger boat, they start grabbing hold of everything and think they're going to be thrown overboard and eaten by a shark because they've never been on water before. This isn't who Jesus is traveling with. These are men who are out there every day. They've seen these storms before, but it's their opinion, and they get straight to the point, "Lord, save us, we are perishing. The ship is going down, we are all about to die. You need to do something." The storm is described by Matthew literally as a seismos megas. Seismos, in our minds, we tend to think of an earthquake, a great tempest, a weather version, the weather equivalent of a massive earthquake, something that would devastate all of the land around it. The waves were high enough to begin covering the boat, verse 24 tells us, that word covering, literally the idea there of hiding the boat, concealing the boat. You can't see what now looks like a little toy vessel that's out there in the water because of these huge waves that are beginning to lap over the sides of it and starting to cover everything that is on board. The picture then of Jesus just sleeping. With all of the waves about, the wind, the rain, the torrents, the darkness, the howling noise of all of that, maybe the cries of fear from all the men who are on board, here is Jesus sleeping. Such a wonderful image. We often think of this in companion piece with Philippians 4 and verse 7 that describes that peace of our Lord that surpasses all understanding. Blessed peace. And really, this is what I suppose that looks like in practice. The disposition of one who has absolute trust in the Father and can know true rest because he has abandoned worry. He is not concerned about what will happen to him. He is not worried. He is not afraid. He is not to be intimidated or cowed. He is simply content and faithful and confident in the power of his Father. There might also, of course, be something to the idea that some have pointed out. Perhaps this is simply demonstrating to us the Lord's exhaustion after his hours of taxing work recently. That could perhaps be part of it, but I don't think it would be the whole balance. Here is Jesus resting with contentment in his Father. In contrast, the disciples do not have that absolute trust. Kenny Chumbly, in his commentary, points out that their appeal to Jesus for help could, at first glance, be seen as an act of faith. Here are men who have a problem and they come to Jesus for help. Isn't that what we want? I mean, isn't that what we praised two men for doing in our lesson this morning? A centurion who comes and says, "Lord, I need help, save him." A leper who comes to Jesus and says, "Lord, I need help, save me." And in both of those cases, we see Jesus saying, "Great work. This is what you should have done." Instead, here Jesus first rebukes them before rebuking the storm and says, "You have little faith. You are acting cowardly." Their cowardice is shown because they didn't really trust. Jesus had not said, as Chumbly points out, "Let us go into the middle of the sea and drown." He had said, "Let us go to the other side." Where's he going to take you then? If you're trusting in the Lord, what do you think he's going to do when you set off on that voyage with him? Is he going to go where he intended to go? Or is he going to leave you all stranding out there to fend for yourselves and ultimately to go down with the ship? Their trust evaporates. Despite their failing this test, of course, and that is what it was, in time, these men, we have among them hardy men, good men, godly men, who will in time, the book of Acts will show for us very clearly, will in time face storms much more vexing than this and will not despair for their lives in those cases. They'll stand strong. and many of them will die on their feet. But despite their failing this particular test, here's Jesus, the master of the sea, who does, in fact, calm it. And here is where we see what he is. The great storm that we saw described there in verse number 24, a great tempest, becomes in verse 26 a great calm. Immediately, from one to another, the Lord calming everything, instantaneous peace, and so they rightly marvel and ask a pertinent question. Who is this? Who can this be in light of what we have just seen? But we move on to verse 28 and see a different storm that's raging, not one of weather, but of spiritual torment. Jesus encounters here two demon-possessed men of the Gergesenes. Let's read in verse 28 beginning. When he had come to the other side, to the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. And suddenly they cried out, saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now, a good way off from them, there was a herd of many swine feeding. So the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, permit us to go away into the herd of swine." And he said to them, "Go." So when they had come out, they went into the herd of swine. And suddenly the whole herd of swine ran violently down the steep place into the sea and perished in the water. Then those who kept them fled, and they went into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they begged him to depart from their region. This entire account is a bit spooky, haunting. You have the backdrop of these tombs, the ferocity of these possessed men, the image that comes to our mind, I guess influenced by modern fiction. What would it sound like when a demon-possessed man spoke? Would that have some kind of unearthly quality? No indication that it would, but the mind certainly goes there, doesn't it? To hear a man speak with a voice that is not really his own, but is in fact speaking on behalf of this demon, it's a haunting thing. The allusions that they make to some spiritual reality of the unseen world that undergirds our own, their mention here of the time and their fear of Jesus, his acknowledgement of them as real beings of some degree of power. The entire account is a bit unsettling to us. Consider also the spiritual world and matters such as this, this demon possession, represents something, I believe, in which we have absolutely no innate power. We have incredibly limited understanding of those things. Even today, people talk about demon possession in the Scriptures. How did it happen? What did it look like? What does it mean? You get all sorts of answers. You get all sorts of opinions on what that might be, what it might mean, what it might entail. We have almost no way of measuring or observing things that exist or occur on that plane, this unseen spiritual world. It is not our natural element, so to speak, as human beings on this planet. When we place it alongside the other miracles that Jesus has worked in this chapter, ones involving demons show, I think, very clearly man's total inadequacy to deal with the problem. We can understand how some diseases work and eventually find cures for almost all of them. Really, humanity has been quite impressive in our own way, in our ingenuity, in our tenacity, in trying to cure the afflictions that plague all of us. And eventually we can look at cells and we can study the bacteria and study the viruses and figure out what is going on and render some kind of cure for that. Well, those are things that men are able to figure out in some way, piece together. We can't control the weather yet, outside of comic books. Maybe that's something that some evil scientist is working on somewhere and is making headway in. I don't know. We can't do that, but as we read about these men out there on this boat being tossed about, we understand we can build vessels today that can pretty easily survive even the sternest winds and the highest waves, we at least, at the very least, know what we're dealing with when we encounter disastrous weather. We can give some warning ahead of time. We can avoid it. Don't get on the boat that day, and maybe you can just stay out of that. But a demon, what does a man do against a spiritual adversary when he's left to himself? If it's just the man on the island, he doesn't have a vaccine, he doesn't have a boat, he doesn't have a life vest, he doesn't have antibiotics. He's just facing this demon alone, and it ravages him. Of course, one of the most famous features of this story is really the climax of it, where we see Jesus seemingly acquiescing. I don't think necessarily he is giving his permission to these demons so much as he is dismissing them, tossing them away. Go from this man. The men who are being healed are of greatest import to Jesus, who simply says, as he would have said to Satan himself in chapter 4, go. You go away. And this is where they end up. But Jesus seemingly acquiescing to the demon's plea and casting them into a herd of swine. Modern audiences with a love for animals, I would include myself, I don't want to see a pig die for no reason. Modern audiences are kind of shocked by this, the seemingly callous destruction here. Jesus just killed all those animals. Oh man, what a terrible thing. Even if we aren't worried about the pigs' lives, which I don't think would be of greatest importance in this scenario, but even if we really just don't care about that at all, what about the owner of that herd? He's just lost some income. He's just lost what was probably a pretty sizable investment when he paid for all those animals. Doesn't Jesus care about what happens to that guy who has now lost some earnings, maybe even his whole livelihood? Was Jesus being a little bit reckless or careless? Or was he trying to teach us something? I think you can anticipate. I'm going to go with the second answer to that. Yes, I think he's trying to teach something here. First of all, those who would relegate demon possession, the very idea of it, to a mental disorder. Hypnotism, mass delusion, something that has happened just within the mind of a person, mundane but supposedly scientific explanations for what actually was happening in the Bible when we read about a person being possessed by a demon. We have a lot of people who just try to pawn that off as something that I could explain if you let me hook up the right device to a guy's head. I could tell you exactly what he's being afflicted with, and it doesn't have anything to do with demons. This story leaves that man a lot to deal with, because pigs are not susceptible to shared mass delusion with humans. Pigs cannot, so far as I know, be hypnotized and tricked into running off of a cliff as one body in a herd. If demon possession was not real and was simply different from simple physical diseases, what is it that's happening to this herd? That would be quite a shocking coincidence and a complete upheaval of everything that nature shows us if these pigs just decide at the very right moment, let's go run off that cliff. This is telling us that what is happening to these two men is something that is real. It's not imagined. It's not just another outgrowth of a mental illness, a disorder. This is a real spiritual ailment that Jesus is banishing. But secondly, as one writer has put it, hell's chaos and destructiveness are illustrated here. What occurred here is no different than what happens with lab animals. It's better to see how a drug affects an animal before it is given to a man. When hell is in control, panic, havoc, and ruin ensue. We would be wise to look at this account and understand the total devastation that evil brings about. The things that belong to Satan and his side, his powers, his realm and sphere of control and influence, the things that have to do with him, the demonic forces, the dark forces of this world. Here is on full display what that leads to. What does that bring about? Fun, good times, just a raucous, riotous time on this earth where you just enjoy yourself all the time. And that's what it means to live on that side of life. We're just kind of enjoying everything the devil has to offer. No, what that brings about is this. Madness, self-harm, the destruction that one just flings himself headlong into. Like a wild, rabid animal just charging off the face of a cliff. Why would we dabble and give it any measure of control over ourselves? Why would you participate in sin? Why would you participate in anything that Satan finds to be worthwhile? Avoid it entirely. This is what it brings. Just as well, we see the power of Jesus accentuated. He demonstrates mastery over yet another realm, the spiritual. There's seemingly nothing that he cannot do. Quickly, and I will finish in just a moment. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, bring us to the climax of this part of the story. Jesus has demonstrated his mastery over sickness. All kinds of diseases, we are told, were brought to him, and he healed them. We've seen his mastery over the natural world, the very elements of our existence itself. We've seen that he has dominion in the spiritual world. Even the unseen things that we cannot observe ourselves with the naked eye, Jesus has control over those forces as well. But look at verse 1 of chapter 9. He got into a boat, crossed over, and came to his own city. Then behold, they brought to him a paralytic lying on a bed. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, "Son, be of good cheer, your sins are forgiven you." And at once, some of the scribes said within themselves, "This man blasphemes." But Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, "Why do you think evil in your hearts? For which is easier, to say, 'Your sins are forgiven you,' or to say, 'Arise and walk'? But that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins," then he said to the paralytic, "Arise, take up your bed, and go to your house." And he arose and departed to his house. Now when the multitude saw it, they marveled and glorified God, who had given such power to men. Here's the crowning part of this section. Greatest of all, in addition to all the power he has already displayed, Jesus can do what only God can do. A confession that these men have voluntarily made unwittingly. Who can forgive sins but God alone, they will say in the parallel accounts of this. No one can. Only God can. And so Jesus will do just that. He can forgive sin. Again, note that the purpose of all of these miracles is to demonstrate his authority to do just that. It's what Matthew seems to have been leading up to with this account, and what the gospel itself is leading up to. That you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. Jesus can do it. He is capable of it. He has the power, he has the authority to do just that. And here is the proof. Matthew is saying to us, look at how easily he has handled everything else, every other difficulty, problem, every other thing that the universe knows of to bring against man. Jesus can deal with it. It's easier to say, as Jesus asks, it's easier to say that you can forgive sin, I think is the point of his question here. That's something that can't be checked out and verified. It's easy to say something that is unprovable. It's difficult, on the other hand, to say, "Arise and walk," because what might happen? If you don't really have the power, if you're a charlatan, that guy's not going to arise and walk. You're going to look very, very foolish. You would have been better not saying anything. But if you want to say, "His sins are forgiven him," well, you can at least argue about that. If someone says, "No, they're not, you can't do that." Can too. How do you know I didn't? There's no way to prove that. There's no way to verify that unless you're capable of doing what Jesus does here. Who's essentially saying to them, the difficult part is in making a claim that can be subjected to real testing. The man will either arise and walk or he won't, and then we'll know the truth. So the scribes accused him of blasphemy after, in Jesus' mind, the easy part. But Jesus then says, essentially, what is your opinion going to be after the difficult part is shown to be true? Are you going to believe now? This is how you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. He says the easy part and means it, but then he says the difficult part and he does it. Do you believe him now? Do you understand now what he is all about and what he is trying to do for man? Some of them did. They marveled and glorified God who had given such power to men and who had shown such grace towards them. This evening, we recommend this Savior to each one who is here. I hope our reflection on the power of Jesus tonight has been useful in some way to each of us. I hope that we see him more clearly in every day of our lives. I hope that we understand his authority, that we listen to him because of who he is, that we follow him because of who he is, that we trust him completely because of who he is, that we appeal to him alone to save us because of who he is. Jesus can still forgive sin and still does and still wants to. This evening, if you would take advantage of his sacrifice on your behalf, if you would answer this question that we're about to sing, who will follow Jesus? If you will, obey the Lord tonight while there is opportunity. Come forward right now while we stand and sing this song.